Welcome to this talk from the Canando Zen Meditation Center. Located in Mountain View, California, Canando's meditation practice is open to the public. For more information or to get in touch with us, you can visit our website at canando.org. That's K-A-N-N-O-N-D-O.org.
Our speaker tonight is Giuseppe Prisco, and Giuseppe will be doing his talk from Italy, I believe. Thank you for joining us this morning, Giuseppe, and or your time. And do you have a name for your talk?
Title of my talk is Peaceful Action. Okay, thank you. Thank you for having me, for the invitation. I appreciate it very much. I want to talk about peace, which is a very important thing for everybody, for anyone. The word shanti is what is used in India. Or Shama. And the ancient Indian word in Sanskrit is Ahimsa, the non-violence principle. In my own native language, it's Pace. And in Spanish, I think it's Paz. And in Russian is Mir. And in Ukrainian is Mir. In Hebrew is Shalom. And in Arabic is Salam. In Japanese, I had to look it up. And it's Heiwa. And in Chinese, Mandarin Chinese, is happening. And there are also many signs that we associate with peace. Like shaking hands, or a smile from the heart, you know, or even just meeting one's gaze in tranquility. And also all the signs that are used for greeting each other, that we use for greeting each other, are signs of peace, such as a hug or a kiss on the cheek. And of course, a bow, the gesture that we do, the gassho. No doubt, in one way or another, we are able to convey to each other the message of peace, to understand each other. We all know what peace is, what we mean. On different levels, we feel a relationship between inner peace and outer peace. And we might also feel that their difference might be illusory. But when we try to find a clear, shared definition for peaceful behavior, we fail. When we try, it seems that we find something more important or fundamental for the defense of which we are willing to modify our definition of peace. And then there might be disagreement. To some, it may seem that we have abandoned a truly peaceful behavior. And maybe to us, we are merely following a more rational or just definition of peace. So peace is not something that we are able to reach an agreement about at an intellectual level. We don't agree intellectually of what constitutes a peaceful behavior. And our Zen practice stands out for its non-intellectual nature. Suzuki Roshi, our teacher, wrote, "I discovered that it is necessary, absolutely necessary, to believe in nothing." This is from Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind. And I take it as an anti-intellectual statement, which is very surprising in the modern world for us. Because I think we are all used to give a positive value to being convinced of our own ideas. We give a very positive value on having good, on the goodness of our opinions. So in our practice, all the different parts of our practice, Zazen, the sitting meditation, the walking meditation, the chanting of the sutras, the ritual work activities that we do, Samu, are all actions performed in a non-intellectual manner. Of course, there is the question about Dharma talks. We can leave it aside. You might think about that while I speak. I have read a story about one of the first encounters that is known between Western people and Zen practice. It's a story about a Jesuit missionary who, in order to convert Japanese people, tried first to learn something about their philosophy and arrived in Japan in 1549. And he became friend with a Zen priest named Nanjo and visited his monastery and observed the monks sitting Zazen in the Zendo hall, just like we have done. And he asked the abbot what they were thinking. The abbot answered, "Some are counting up how much they took from the faithful last month. Some are considering where they can get better clothing and treatment for themselves. Others are thinking of their recreations and pastimes. In short, none of them is thinking of anything that makes any sense whatsoever." The Jesuit missionary could not grasp what Zazen was, whether that was some sort of primitive practice, whether it was a religious practice or not. He wanted to apply his categories, intellectual categories, but could not. And the abbot himself seemed to have no need to provide an intellectual explanation of what was happening in the Zendo. And this misunderstanding happens today, still happens today. I have recently listened to a lecture from a university professor of some philosophical subject like aesthetics, who described in his lecture the beautiful garden in a Zen monastery in Japan, and intricate designs traced in the gravel, you know, the stone gardens. And the professor provided many insights into how the garden was maintained according to what he could interpret was the idea of nature of the monks. But then, when we met at the end of the lecture, the professor told us that he had stayed at that monastery personally, and he saw that every day there was a group of monks, of novice monks, who received the task of sweeping and taking care of the garden every day for quite a few hours. And also, every few days, one monk, in turn, was assigned the task of waking up before everyone else at 3 a.m., even before the normal 4 a.m. wake-up call, and redo the lines in the stone garden, working until late morning. And while he was sitting with the monks, the professor heard them all complain among each other about having to do that work, about waking up very early, skipping the meditation and breakfast, getting pain in the legs and in the back. And this surprised the professor very much. Perhaps he perceived those considerations were showing a lack of enthusiasm or sense of sacredness. So you might ask, why am I telling you these stories? What is the meaning of these stories? And this is exactly this, you can notice that this is exactly the spontaneous questions that come to us, because we have a need for an intellectual closed meaning in everything, you know. And this need is similar to the one of the Jesuit missionary, of the professor. It is simply outside of our culture to put a limit on verbal explanations, closed explanations of things. We seem to lose something if we do not have the complete sense. It feels wrong that the dialogue would end without the closed linguistic conclusion. But, you know, the founder of Zen, Bodhidharma, wrote a verse that is most often cited in relation to Zen. It says, a special transmission outside of the scripture, no dependency on words and letters, pointing directly to the human mind, seeing into one's nature and attaining Buddhahood. And especially in the second line, no dependency on words and letters. Words and letters. I think there is clearly an emphasis there, but from my experience, it's almost an understatement. Practicing at Kanon-do, practicing with less, I get the sense that this no dependency on words and letters should be understood in an even broader sense. As a non-dependency, not only on books, but also on the living words of dialogue, or even on reason, to understand logically our practice. Many years ago, I studied the Genjo Koan, which is a writing from Dogen, for a while, and then I asked the Doku-san to meet with Les. And so, you know, early morning, on a Saturday early morning, at 6:30 or something, I showed up there after the prostrations, after we were sitting facing each other. I pulled out three different commentaries of the Genjo Koan, full of bookmarks. And I think I still remember a gesture that Les made of like, you can put them away. We don't need them. We don't need the books that we could do without. And then obviously, early in the morning, sitting in front of my teacher, without the books to rely on, My mind was totally blank. Nothing came to my mind about the Genjo Koan. So I went back and I studied the Genjo Koan some more. In order to be able to talk about it with less precisely, without having the text on hand, memorizing many passages. And then I showed up for Doku-san again, ready for an in-depth dialogue to clarify the meaning of this text. But things did not go as I had imagined. Again, I had imagined something like a dialogue, you know, between Socrates and his philosophy students, like back in Athens, just with the difference that maybe we were sitting facing each other instead of walking in a group down a courtyard. But that was not what lasted in mind. What actually happened was that we ended up talking about something that was happening at that moment in my mind, in my life, and which I discovered right then it was more important to me than the Genjo Koan. So no dialogue as we think about it in the West to polish or clarify truth. And then, of course, the text himself, if you have a chance to read any Dogen, doesn't leave many possibilities for a logical analysis, logical reasoning. So after a while, I think all of us, each of us in a different way, find his own meaning of this non-dependency of the Dharma teachings on books, on dialogues, on logic. I think also by analogy with other spiritual practices and religious practices that we have been exposed in our life anyway in the West. There are also contemplative practices in our culture. But in our culture, the intellect has also a meaning that goes beyond just the analytic reasoning. We refer really to intellect as kind of a intuitive, also skill, self-intuitive capability that is typical of humans. So intellect can also be interpreted as similar to the concept of self in psychology or to the concept of consciousness in cognitive sciences that are wider than just our reasoning abilities and linguistic expression. And so usually, we form our idea of meditation based on thesis that is our concept of self, of ourself, of consciousness, of our intellect in the sense also an intuition, because that is much more natural for us, is much more intuitive than the idea of Zazen, of practice that is based on the absence of a self. So I want to share out for me is I think it's very difficult for anyone to go beyond the paradigm of self in our meditation practice. In this paradigm, we can, you know, there can be cultivation of calm, silence, inner silence in the mind, a clearer perception of things. A feeling of an inner space, a feeling of our center of consciousness, self-awareness that is more lucid than normal, a different perception of time and space, and an inner peace. Something similar to a lack of urgency to respond to external stimuli, external things, desires. But this can still all fall within our normal paradigm of self. But and in our culture, I think this is the practice of virtue, you know, of self-control, and also the virtue to refine one's ability to have a vision for something larger, you know, depending on one's metaphysical beliefs, one's beliefs. Could be the vision of something divine or the vision of something immanent in reality, in the one reality. But I think our Zen practice falls outside, goes beyond this paradigm of contemplation associated to self, consciousness or intellect, intuitive intellect, any way we call it. And our Zen practice falls outside the idea of a path to refine a capacity for contemplation. And that's why I think we are quite lost in continuing the practice of Zazen. Once you leave also this last cultural ground, we don't have points of reference. And we might even doubt, you know, this practice, that it has anything to it. We might think, we might even have doubts that it's just a primitive practice, or that in Western traditions, there are other, there's nothing more than other, nothing different than other mystical practices. And it's just as a different cultural background, this Japanese background, which is totally fine opinion. But I think there is more to it. There is still different and new to our Western background. And usually we search in at this point in the direction of samadhi, of like absorptions, of deep meditation. And I heard different people, many people in our group describe states of absorption. You sit in zazen, time goes by, you don't notice, even if you're awake and attentive to your surrounding, even if your eyes are open, it doesn't feel like anymore your gaze is on the wall. It's a bit like Neruda's poetry, as if the eyes had flown away like butterflies. I think you know that our teacher, Les, doesn't seem to indicate that these deep meditation states are, you know, some step forward in a certain, on a path, on something to cultivate specifically. Even though they might bring some excitement and also a sense of well-being, the samadhi is something typical of Eastern spiritual practices, such as Buddhism and Zen. But it's not the component of practice in which this non-intellectual nature of Zen, I think, is to be found. So I think the non-intellectual disposition, non-intellectual part of Zen is in this disposition, this peaceful disposition, with the peace of all the things around us, internal and external. I think this, the non-intellectual nature is in the action that comes, that arises immediately, that we have seen, I think, in our practice, less modeling for us. You know, an appropriate natural response to every request without an intellectual mediation, without an intellectual thinking, and the self-discipline to remain continuously in this ready disposition. So I've talked now for quite a while, but I'm not sure what I've talked about. When I was, I remember that when I was 16, I really enjoyed a book from an American writer, Raymond Carver, with the title, What Do We Talk About When We Talk About Love? And this comes to mind to me because I've been reading a series of Dharma talks from Les, and I got a sensation similar to that I got from reading that book. What do we talk about when we talk about Dharma? You know, is the writer was actually describing scenes of ordinary couple life, coexistence, trivial exchanges of words while wandering around the house, doing little tasks, drinking a glass of wine, in an atmosphere that didn't have a narrative. Could be interpreted as ambiguous between boredom and tranquility. So I think we've all listened to many Dharma talks from Les, and you know that he doesn't explain the Dharma relating it to concepts and knowledge from other disciplines, modern disciplines. It doesn't explain the Dharma in psychological terms or in neuroscience terms or science, quantum theory, or complex systems. And it doesn't even refers to the humanities, you know, our tradition of philosophy, history, and whatever. It doesn't relate the Dharma in similarity or opposition to any concept previously known to us. So I think he manages to stay faithful to the non-intellectual nature of our practice. And this is not just because he's a traditional Zen master. That's what he's known for. But I think because this non-intellectual attitude is what brings the inner peace and the outer peace. And shifts the emphasis to a non-egocentric action, to joining the activity in the moment, to this action and compassion that are always together, and to some essence of Zen that escapes any definition. Thank you, and if there are questions, this is the time.
Hello, can you see me?
Yes.
I'm Julian.
Hi, Julian.
Hi. My question is, how would I phrase it? Speaking directly from the heart, what peaceful advice can you give to nations who find themselves stuck in a state of war?
You know, Julian, I thank you for the question. It was in the back of my mind. I think it's in the back of my mind all the time these days. And as I've been thinking about it, I've realized that it's not possible to talk to nations. Nations are not human beings. So we can only talk to human beings. And try to help directly from person to person, okay? Doing things to in support of peace, doing what we can do to support peace at every level, from the super small level of asking a question nicely and trying to answer to a question nicely, to the level of bringing family in our personal relationship, bringing peace in our personal relationships in our family, to the level of trying to help with projects, maybe in our community, that support the awareness of the importance of peace. And there are also then ways in organization to support, help people that are very far away, but that we can support directly people that maybe are in areas of war, and that we can support directly with some programs that connects people to people. So I think there are ways, but is there, and I think it's important to get engaged, but I don't believe they go through organizations that are the result of people, but they don't have a conscience, you know, they have something that feel the pain.
Hello. Hi, I'm Guo Guo.
Hi.
I just got started with Zen Buddhism. I'm reading Diamond Sutra in both the tradition, in Chinese and English translation. And it really, it's hard to understand why does the mind being translated as the heart in original Chinese. So like in Tibetan Buddhism, they also do body, speech, mind. Mind is in the heart. So it's very confusing to me. I guess I'm still intellectualizing, but I just want to throw the question out there so people help me think about it. Thank you.
Oh, imagine how difficult is for me. I don't even have any idea of Chinese. I probably know two ideograms. So for me, it's even more confusing. I have to rely on translations and studies. It quickly gets very intellectual. And some traditions put more emphasis on defining terms very carefully, analytically, and trying to create a theory that has the same, that can share a cultural background with our Western thinking of analytical thinking and philosophy. And so that could be interesting to read, but for me, it always loses something. It always tries to make things not alive and it leads to other misunderstandings. So it's I feel your pain, but your interest, I think, is in the right direction. It's the same interest I have for really understanding with my heart or with my mind, or just understanding this teaching. Thank you.
Giuseppe, Dan,
and Dan.
Over time, have you found that you've you rely less on, you're less concerned with the intellectual concerns that you have, or they stick with you just as much as ever, and you deal with them, for instance, in the same way as you always have? Has there been a change over time for you?
I have kind of intellectual needs. You know, my brain needs to be working on something. So I need to feed something to my brain. It's like my stomach. It gets hungry, it needs some food. You give your stomach some food, and And then for sometimes you don't hear about your stomach. And I think that's the experience I have of this right now. I've been trying to put myself on a strict diet, and you know that doesn't work. You put yourself on a strict diet, there is a real need that is not met, and it can get you out of balance. So, but of course, we all know, you know, that we don't live to eat, you know, and that sometimes we eat because we want to comfort ourselves, which is also fine, but of course cannot take over our lives either. So I consider intellectual thinking, learning, studying things, something I have to take care of. I have my level, you know, different people. Some people eat less, some people eat more. I have kind of learned over time what is the level that keeps me satisfied. I don't want more. and I move forward without thinking too much about it. And how about yourself?
I think I've become less less tight about it. I think I continue to have the mental activity, but I don't, I'm okay with not knowing more than I used to be. It doesn't seem to bother me as much. At some point, I let it go, you know, more often. Thanks for asking. It's 8:54 here. We're almost at an end. Are there any final questions or concerns?
Giuseppe?
Oh, yeah.
Could you say more about the self-discipline to stay in peaceful mind?
What I've come to notice for myself is how quick is my mind to react to things. Incredibly quick to switch from and respond sometimes impulsively. In a way that could be not the best conduct for peace. So I think there is a self-discipline of as described in our tradition of watching over oneself. That can get refined, that get with which we get more experience we get, the less we get fooled by our very quick reaction, that being quick make us lose our general understanding of things, more larger picture, and the importance of peace. So this reaction I'm talking about are not only physical reactions, but also just mental leaps, just quick conclusions that we get to, and we get to so quickly that we then accept non-critically, without criticizing them, without considering all the sides. That this can happen either because it's our own idea that pops up, but it's not been really scrutinized, and it's not in line with a real peaceful behavior, or it could be something we hear, we read, we take in from our culture, and we don't have the time, we don't take the time to really consider it, and then we don't realize that it's not in line with more peacemaking attitude. So I think this is the discipline that I can think of. Was there something specifically you had in mind?
No, thank you. You answered the question.
Thank you, Giuseppe. Thanks.
Thank you, Sam.
Your time. What time is it there?
6 a.m.
Very good.
This talk was brought to you by the Canando Zen Meditation Center in Mountain View, California. For more information or to support this podcast, go to canando.org. That's K-A-N-N-O-N-D-O.org.